Jenkins is a familiar voice on this program and to listeners around the country. As a longtime director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, or COHA, he is regularly called upon by the national, international press, network, radio, TV, public affairs programs to comment on developments in Latin America and can be relied upon for informed opinion, not filtered through anyone's agenda or any group's agenda. Long before coming to KZYX, I used to listen to Larry Burns being interviewed on Berkeley's KPFA and decided when I started hosting this program that he was the one I would call when it came to learning what was happening in Latin America. Good morning, Larry. Let's start with Nicaragua, with the return to the presidency of Daniel Ortega and the appointment of Robert Gates of Iran-Contra infamy. It seems, as Yogi Berra would say, it's deja vu all over again. But despite the support he received from Hugo Chavez, this appears to be a very different Ortega than we saw a couple of decades ago. How do you size him up now?
Well, as he's lived out his life, it's not been particularly beautiful. And we can go back to 1990, when he was defeated in the presidential race, which was by Violeta Chamorro, and $20 or $25 million in U.S. covert funding. And we developed a cycle there where Ortega persistently, in the election in 1990, in the election in 1996, in the election in 2001, all of which he has lost, and all of which he lost by between 35, he got between 35 and 40% of the vote. That is, there was roughly 50% of the Nicaraguan population wouldn't vote for him under any circumstances. And so, as a realist, and probably deeply frustrated by this the fact that his fellow countrymen were turning him down every 4 or 5 years in the presidential race, he thought up an idea with a discredited ex-president of Nicaragua, a man named Arnaldo Alemán, who, and together they worked out a system that you no longer needed either an absolute majority or the previous system where you had to get 40% of the vote and be 5 points ahead of anyone else, and you could win on the first round. What Ortega suggested was 35% with a 5-point spread. This enabled Ortega to win this election that we've just witnessed because he got around 38% of the vote. He would have had to have gone to a second round if he wasn't able to get that percentage. And if the conservatives didn't split in two different factions, which split the anti-Ortega vote, but in a second round, in any event, they would have coalesced in the coalition, and Ortega would have lost. Now, another provision that Ortega had. Now, remember, Ortega controls 40% of the nation. The Sandinista Party is probably the largest single political party in Nicaragua, but it's a different kind of party than we had during the 1980s, when Nicaragua was locked in a civil war that cost them 30,000 casualties, 30,000 fatalities. What we had here was a Daniel Ortega who, for personal reasons, faced a law trial, a law case involving prosecution involving his stepdaughter. And ex-President Alemán faced prosecution for embezzling over $100 million of public funds. So they conjured up, and since they controlled the majority in the Nicaraguan legislature between the two individuals, they conjured up a system whereby ex-presidents of the country would be granted blanket immunity. So neither one could be tried. In addition to this, Ortega changed his political thing. He became a pragmatist. He announced a return to the church. He announced that he would oppose abortion. And he became friends with the very conservative Cardinal Obando of Nicaragua, who was his mortal enemy during the Sandinista Wars of the 1980s. An entirely different guy. Some days of the week, in campaigning, he would talk about, using the Pope's words, savage capitalism, condemned it, condemned Ronald Reagan for visiting such destruction on Nicaragua during the 1980s, and talking triumphantly about his relationship with Hugo Chavez. On other days, he talked about, as he campaigned, usually in non-poverty areas, because he made his greatest identification with the poor. He would campaign on the basis of making references to Jesus Christ, touting the small business community in Nicaragua, and talking about his desire to have a constructive relationship with the United States. So there were two Daniel Ortegas, and it all depended on what day you were listening to him and what crowd he was addressing.
You know, it's interesting that before he left office, he and some of his Sandinista cronies distributed some large estates among themselves, and one of them he confiscated was the one of his current running mate, Jaime Morales, who was a former Contra.
Yes, that was very touching. I immediately thought of Shakespeare, and I guess it was Prince Edward that is the villain married the courted and married the widow of his brother, the prince, who he had arranged to have killed. And I thought that was a great thing to choose Morales as his running mate to be vice president after seizing his house and settling down in it. I thought that was a poetic touch.
You know, I have a very negative memory of Ortega back from the days. A story you may recall when he came to New York and with a 17-car entourage, this is when he was president and the Sandinistas were in power, and Americans, supporters of Nicaragua, were going around the country collecting money for pencils for Nicaraguan school children, and Ortega and his wife stopped at a designer sunglass store, or so glass store in New York, Madison Avenue, and bought $2,000 worth of designer sunglasses. And at a meeting in New York where Ortega was speaking, someone tried to question him about it and was shouted down by the other people in the audience, which was a very sad reflection both on the audience, but an example of where Ortega really was, and a man for all seasons, I guess. Now, it's interesting, he was pushed by Hugo Chavez, and from his illness, sick bed, Fidel Castro. But are they scheduled for a disappointment, or is it going to be a tug of war between Chavez and the Bush administration for his services?
Nicaragua is very much locked into a relationship with Washington. It is over 50% of its trade is with the United States. It is not a very competitive country economically. It's a very poor country, second or third poorest country in Latin America today. Yet it's handicapped in one respect by having very militant trade unions in certain sectors of the economy, which means that those countries like Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador that don't have those strong unions, that have company unions, if at all, they can negotiate at much lower rates, and they produce the same kind of thing as Nicaragua does. So he's pulled by that association. He's pulled by the need to maintain markets for his tropical fruits and for his assembly industry products and textiles, the light industry, that's what Nicaragua has. And because his popularity could sag very quickly if he doesn't produce fast. We saw that even in Venezuela in 2003, before the prices of oil began to spike, and with it came an oil premium upwards of $15 billion that Chavez could later invest in his social justice programs like medicine and education and subsidized supermarkets and sports programs. So within a year, his popularity had gone, which had sunk to 38%, had climbed up to almost 60%, based upon the fact that the poor, who was Chavez's major constituency, began to feel that Chavez was just another one of these blah-blah people who promise a lot of things but don't deliver. And so they visited their wrath on Chavez. Then when the goods began to arrive and his promises were fleshed out in achievement, then his popularity began to grow very significantly. Now, I actually visited Ortega for a week once in the early 80s as his guest, and I thought of him as being a very engaging person, and he struck me as a very humanistic person. I have not been in touch with him since then, and I certainly remember the designer glass incident. He, of course, would insist that he had no idea what they had cost. He simply sent someone in to buy a pair of glasses for him. And people in government don't usually do the buying and don't take out their credit card, and then someone else handles that. The quality of the man seems to have deteriorated. One respect of that is the way he would expel. He ran the party very autocratically. That is, during the years that the Zelenistas were out of power. And for example, Herky Lewitt, who man from the Sandinistas who started his own party after being expelled from the Sandinistas because he dared to raise the issue of whether he might run against Ortega for the nomination within the party primary. So he later died of a heart attack, but Ortega's conduct as a party leader was very authoritarian and extremely unattractive. It almost was if it was a reflection on the dearth of quality candidates running in this election that Ortega really stood out. And also, he had gone to great efforts to woo the small business community, which in fact, in the election, voted for him. They may have given the decisive number of votes that enabled him to get over 35% of the ballots.
I think he got 38. Now, yes. It's interesting, Oliver North went down there to lobby against Ortega. Do you think that had an effect on the election at all at this point, one way or another?
I think that I was once on Oliver North's radio program, and he introduced me to the audience by saying, he was much less gracious than you. He said, "This is my favorite left winger, my favorite lefty, Larry Burns. There he is." I thought that was kind of a vulgar act for him to go down to Nicaragua. I'm not so sure it brought him any additional votes. The country has a huge economic deficit to overcome, and Nicaragua was extremely badly handled by U.S. policy at the time. And it wasn't just the casualties, although they were enormous, like 30,000, but it also was the property damage. You take a country whose capital stock is in, you know, there are people in the United States with more money than the GDP of Nicaragua. One person would have more money. And so when you go in and you bomb and you blow up ports and bridges and you... you have to get a lot of IMF loans, World Bank loans, to reconstruct that destroyed property. It takes a long time. In fact, it's never been done. And you go to Nicaragua today, the roads are impassable, the public facilities are terrible, the schools are in terrible shape. It's bad.
Well, that's a tragedy, because under the Sandinistas, at least, they had a well-developed educational program, I guess, modeled on that of Cuba.
Yes, they had a rather wonderful literacy program. And, that is, Ortega readily confesses to his excesses during his presidency and so forth. It was less systemic than it was personal. That is, they weren't really much into administering. You wouldn't want them to fill the potholes over the winter, and those are the things that quickly lose you your prosperity and your popularity. People like Morris Bishop of Grenada, and not Salvador Allende, who stayed home trying desperately to administer the Chilean economy and no funds, but so many of these people have a basic feeling that the world is waiting for them to speak, and that they are capable of making big politics and coming forth with big visions that will transport the country from where it is right now to where it wants to go. And certainly a man like Hugo Chavez is perhaps the most compelling figure in Latin America today. I mean, Lula is a pale shadow compared to the kind of thinking, the inventive, innovative thinking that Chavez does. Now, sometimes he micromanages projects. Other times, he tends to forget them. And so you have a whole series of huge reform initiatives that he introduced and which have kind of faded off and are not being executed on a day-to-day basis.
Well, it's getting to, speaking of Chavez, he had this long, weeks-long struggle with the United States in the General Assembly, trying to get Venezuela, the temporary Security Council seat, with the U.S. proxy being Guatemala, one of the more pathetic countries in the region, which ended up with Panama as a compromise. Who was the winner in that, and what support did Chavez had in that from Latin America?
Well, in Latin America, as the Venezuelan ambassador will tell you, in Latin America, they got 80% of the votes. 80% of the votes there went to... now, I don't know whether what the ambassador meant was 80% of the population, the government's representing the population, or 80%, but he felt that that was an important statistic to keep in mind. Now, the United States put a lot of effort, a lot of resources, a lot of IOUs into this campaign. Now, it was not a recorded vote. It was a voice vote. It was a secret ballot. So we don't know how people voted, except those who volunteered the information afterward. But it was, Chavez wanted this as a sign of international prestige. And the United States opposed the Chavez-Venezuelan desire to have that two-year temporary non-veto UN Security Council seat. Well, everyone said because he wanted to give long lectures, long speeches to the United States or to the international audience. In fact, those speeches are listened to very few people. That really doesn't have a mass audience. And I didn't quite understand why so much passion was being put into the fight to get one of those seats. But once the issue was drawn, I think that Chavez made, or the Venezuelans had made, a pretty good case. They didn't mention it, but they could have mentioned it, that Guatemala, as you suggested, Jeff, that Guatemala was the least suitable candidate for that post. First of all, it was Latin America's prime human rights violator in the decade when that occurred. And it did not accept the 1996 UN-brokered peace accords that ended the civil conflict in Honduras. They never, that is, the government never approved it. And the basic reforms and the acknowledgement of the killings, we're talking about over 200,000 people killed since 1969, often in these brutal ambushes where 50 to 100 people would be killed, including children and women. And Guatemala has never apologized for this, and never has made due to the survivors or the relatives of the victims. In addition to that, the Guatemala didn't even run its campaign. The United States swallowed up the campaign. And in fact, the foreign minister of Guatemala, a very appealing person named Gert Rosenthal, he privately mentioned that he feels like Jonah being in the belly of the whale, the United States, in the way that Washington took over this campaign. Panama, as a substitute country, as a compromise, it was actually suggested by Chavez for the arcane reason that he was rather fond of Torrijos's father, Omar Torrijos, who had been the great authoritarian leader of Panama in the 60s, 1960s, early 70s, that he voted because Martin Torrijos is currently the president. That's why Venezuela proposed Panama as a compromise candidate, and why it was accepted by the other nations. That was somewhat embarrassing for us because we brought out a press release the same week saying that Panama would be a terrible compromise candidate.
Oh, given, you speak of COHA.
COHA, yes. And in fact, what we did is used St. Lucia as one of the few pure countries. Now, to my uncontested delight, the next day, the Los Angeles Times ran a story saying that a number of compromise candidates have been mentioned. They said the Dominican Republic and Panama and St. Lucia. Now, my colleagues in the office were quite overwhelmed by this because I told them before we did this, I said, we will make a good country into being, getting that seat. Because actually, St. Lucia is a wonderful country. It remained totally one of the few CARICOM, Caribbean countries, that stood steadfast in not recognizing the Gerard Latour II interim government in Haiti that had been installed by the United States as a substitute for President Aristide. And they had a good environment record in terms of fighting the developers. I mean, it was just a great little history. And I thought, of course, they had much chance winning that. The Jamaican toboggan team had of winning the Olympics, but why not? What the hell?
Well, that's interesting. I appreciate that information. I wasn't aware of that, and I was actually laughing when you mentioned the story in the LA Times. But I'm sure our listeners also were not aware of that. What effect do you think the Tuesday's elections are going to have on U.S. Latin American relations? I know Tom Lantos is scheduled to become the head of the House Internal Relations Committee, although Howard Berman may contest that. But Lantos has been very vicious in his attacks on Hugo Chavez. So what do you think is in store for Latin America with the Democrats in power?
They all have been. They all have been, that is, presidential candidate Kerry spoke very abusively of Chavez. Nancy Pelosi did as well, called him sort of a thug. The problem is that none of these people know anything about this Latin American scenario. It's quite strange to them. Those people who do know about the subject, and that is would be Seth Kennedy, who's always been a great Latin Americanist, and Tom Dodd of Connecticut, who had served in the Peace Corps as a youth. And certainly it was rather well informed, but on a number of occasions when I testified on the Hill, he was always one of the most kind of pragmatic people. For example, in one case we were testifying against the former deputy chief of mission to Chile, a man named Harry Schroederman, during the Allende period, to be the ambassador to Venezuela. And the Venezuelan newspaper, I guess it was called El Universal, it said, its headline for that day said, Kissinger says that Schroederman should be in Caracas. Burns says he should be in jail.
Well, wasn't he the ambassador to El Salvador?
He was the...
Or something.
No, Bob White was ambassador to El Salvador. He was later became... He did become ambassador, I think it was, to Argentina that he became ambassador. But the fact is that... that Latin America gets very little quality time from the State Department. And this State Department has become so ideological. I mean, during the reigns of Otto Reich and Roger Noriega as Assistant Secretaries of State, the State Department was basically, Latin American policy was a function of its Cuba policy. And whereas the United States wiggles and writhes in pleasure when it anticipates any kind of positive note coming out from Pyongyang by the North Korean government, you wouldn't think, or at least it would be difficult to remember that this is the government that killed 30,000 of your people and has perfected the atomic bomb and so forth. Yet at the same time, you contemptuously dismiss Cuba, a country that never killed any Americans, and which has been a pretty good citizen in terms of carrying out international agreements which it has signed. I mean, the policy, the U.S. policy towards Cuba, is a pollutant, and it has severely distressed, if not destroyed, the prospects of U.S. policy towards the hemisphere. And that is why Kerry was running against Bush. In polls taken in Latin America, 85% of the population said that they would vote for Kerry if given half a chance, and even a greater percentage professed opposition to the Iraq war. And, you know, there's a lot of schizoid feelings about this because Latin America is very drawn to American culture and to Americans. And yet, Bush is systematically dismissed in people's minds as a lightweight and as a liar. Yet the Democrats in this area have taken a very disappointing road by not attempting to develop an individual or a foreign policy on its own towards Cuba, towards Venezuela. That is, even the Republicans are voting against the travel ban to Cuba and the trade ban because they want to sell farm state goods, grains, to Cuba. But there's an ideological commitment to Florida, and that commitment is tough. In fact, there's an article that's going to be coming out the next day or two in an Associated Press wire story, in which when this lady called me, the point I was trying to stress was that the Cuban Americans and such organizations as the Cuban American National Foundation and individual rich Cubans will give $2 or $3 million to an election campaign, to the Republican National Committee and so forth. In return, they may get $200 million in public funding of programs, of pet programs, of the community, such as anti-Castro activity and trying to get Cuban athletes to defect, to come, Cuban doctors to defect and come to the United States. The U.S. public is paying for this through the nose for these pet projects of the Cuban-American community.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I know we don't have much time, but I thought maybe he would touch on Bolivia because to me that's one of the most exciting pieces of news coming out of South America. And would he give us an update of what's happening down there, please? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you.
That's funny, Jeff, because the moment before you called, I was working on Bolivia. In fact, we have an intern here from Denmark, and that intern is meeting with the Bolivian ambassador tomorrow to interview him. And we were going over questions that he was going to ask. Well, you know, we're very interested in Bolivia. Evo Morales is a very attractive figure. I felt that when he was campaigning for the presidency and saying that he would nationalize oil and natural gas, Bolivian oil and natural gas, I thought he would buckle once he became president, and that he would do the same thing that Lucio Gutierrez, the president of Ecuador, did, which was to say that, well, I'd like to nationalize this stuff, but we need to bring in foreign investments because that's going to produce the surplus that will enable us to invest in social justice programs. I mean, people always have rational explanations why they repudiate their campaign platforms. Well, Evo Morales didn't, and he formed a very tenacious relationship with Hugo Chavez and with Fidel Castro. They became the three real revolutionaries in Latin America. Now, we have another cohort of countries called the Pink Tide countries. These are countries that the newspapers would describe as left-leaning, and they're led by Lula in Brazil, and would include Tabaré Vasquez and Néstor Kirchner in Argentina. It's a growing number of countries, but their left-leaning should be more accurately translated into being like New Deal programs of modest social reform. That's good, but it's different from what Morales is talking about. Now, Morales has very limited exports, and he's going to require a good deal of investment coming from Venezuela. And if the price of oil remains high, Venezuela will continue to have an extremely active foreign aid program. And I think that Chavez has been driven by genuine eleemosynary feelings that Venezuela should help poorer countries. Well, certainly Bolivia is one of those poorer countries. Mm-hmm. And Morales has turned out to be a guy who he's willing to infuriate the Brazilians and get Lula into a lot of trouble by nationalizing oil holdings and natural gas holdings of Petrobras, the Brazilian state oil company owned in Bolivia. And the United States has been trying to pry him apart from Chavez. They feel that he still can be salvaged because until that natural gas revenue starts coming online, Bolivia is a desperately poor country. But with its steady oil production and the second largest natural gas reserve in Latin America, Bolivia has huge economic prospects for the near to middle future.
Well, it's interesting. Morales also was concerned about his base because I know there's tremendous pressure. There's always tremendous pressure from the base in Bolivia, and there was pressure from the base that supported him to actually produce. And I frankly am as surprised as you are that he has held fast. And of course, we have to look to Venezuela and his assistance, which has enabled him to do that.
Yes, there are lots of things perking there, pipelines being built from here to there, PetroSur, a television network that includes Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, they're all part owners, Venezuela, in order to stress Latin American culture and get it away from playing retreads of U.S. TV series. These countries have a lot of systemic problems. They have massive problems of corruption, of poverty. 35-40% of the population is dirt poor. You have another huge cohort of people who are only partially occupied, partially have jobs. There's been a great failure in job creation in most cases in Latin America. This microcredit that people are speaking about, which this originator got the Nobel Prize for, that selling chewing gum in the streets and washing cars, it's a job, but it's really a substitute for a job. It's for societies that are unwilling to answer questions about their own internal culture.
Larry, I have to cut you short here. It was impossible to cover the region. There were other stories about Cuba and Brazil. I'm going to get back to you in a couple of weeks, in a few weeks, to continue to talk about Latin America.
Excellent, Jeff.
And I want to thank you very much. Your website is www.coha.org. Go to it. It's the most informed site in Latin America that I'm aware of. And I want to get you back here in a couple of weeks.
Excellent.
Let's do that. Continue this conversation.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.